Hello, this is Hillel Tekton in the first of a series of podcasts. This one will be on the current debate and fight around the direction of capitalism at the present time in the context of the overall depression. I call it a depression, though it is very similar to the downturn in the 1930s, because secondly, there's clearly no end to this. It's already lasted from 2007 down to the present, and there is no indication of it actually lifting. At the most, we may be talking about a slow rate of growth. Most commentators talk of a long time before the downturn ends, even if they don't call it a depression. Now, in this period, we've seen some strange phenomena, like, for instance, profits rising in big firms particularly. They're rising very simply because the owners of the firms or the board of directors or the capitalist class realizes that it can dismiss workers without any great hullabaloo, and secondly, that they can keep workers and simply cut their wages, or they can cut wages and dismiss workers. Hence, profits would tend to rise. And a statement to that effect has actually been made by a former minister in Britain, who was duly told to keep quiet. Now, that's the first peculiarity, we can say. Of course, looked at from one angle, it's not a peculiarity, but one doesn't normally expect that capital will simply raise its profits. It's normally expected that profits go down, which leads to a series of features, which then ultimately leads to the reverse, that's to say, a downsizing of firms, a capitalization, and to a revaluation of the assets of the firms, which in turn leads to a new assessment of profits, but on a lower base. Whereas in this case, we actually have the base, if anything, rising. Now, that's the second peculiarity. The second peculiarity is that most big firms, in fact, have a rising stock of cash. That's to say, they are not spending their money, they're not spending their profits, they're not reinvesting. Clearly, if they were to reinvest, you might begin to get some kind of upturn. But they are not doing that. And this is occurring in particularly in the United States, and is very evident in Britain as well. So we are talking of billions in being held by big firms, which are medium-sized firms, which is not being spent. Now, it is also the case that money is simply being deposited in banks in very, very large sums. In what I've written, I've quoted and re-quoted the instance of the Bank of New York Mellon, which holds something like $27 trillion or thereabouts, dollars, for which it administers for others. Well, $27 trillion is an enormous sum, after all. It's almost double the GDP of the United States. It's quite obvious that if that money was used to invest, whether in existing firms or in a massive program of renewal, there would be an upturn. But that isn't happening. So that's a second peculiarity of this situation. It's not that that there wasn't a certain amount of saving in the United States during the Great Depression, but it was nothing like this. This is a new phenomenon. The capitalist class is not prepared to invest under the present circumstances. The reason given is that it doesn't have confidence, and that raises a whole issue. Now, what is the policy officially proclaimed by governments and implicitly and often explicitly by big capital or by the capitalist class or representatives of organizations of industrialists and finance capital? The official policy at first was, of course, a Keynesian one to invest to avoid a total slump, which was then succeeded by a policy of austerity. And that was general. It was the policy, of course, of the Conservative government in Britain. It was the policy of the Conservative government in Germany. And it was, in fact, the policy of the French government, too, and the previous Conservative government in France. It's true that the Italians under Berlusconi did not adopt that slogan, and Berlusconi did not accept it and still doesn't accept it, but he was forced effectively to resign and was succeeded by a so-called technocrat, Monti, who then implemented a policy of austerity. And of course the very conservative government in Spain has in fact been doing it, even if it doesn't use the term. And the same applies to the various other countries which have taken out loans or grants from the EU. Now, the policy has been one of austerity. In today's Guardian, Harry Elliott spent some time crowing over the failure of Osborne, over Osborne's austerity policy. He does this because the IMF has given Osborne a sharp rebuke. Now, the IMF, in fact, before it came to Britain to examine Britain's books, it spent a two-week period doing that, did explicitly say that Britain ought to reverse its policy and go for growth rather than cutting expenditure. But when it actually came to make its report after 2 weeks, as Martin Wolf of the Financial Times pointed out, they wimped out. That's to say, they said the same thing, basically, but in much lower tones. Now, that's to be expected because, after all, the IMF usually consults the government before it makes its final report. And it usually concedes at some level. So, what we have is a policy of austerity on the one hand, which has been adopted by a series of conservative governments, and on the other hand now, the IMF taking a policy of growth rather than austerity. The use of the word austerity is itself important. The way Larry Elliott looks at it, he effectively defines austerity as cutting government expenditure as opposed to raising taxes and going for growth. Now, austerity, in fact, is somewhat broader than that. It's clearly an ideology which is telling the population that the country itself is in trouble, people have to save, people have to make certain that they support the government in its savings. It asks people to accept the viewpoint that public expenditure is in itself not productive, that only the private sector is in fact productive. That's very much part of the austerity program, what amounts to a conservative program saying that public expenditure is necessarily deductive from the private expenditure. It's unproductive. The logic of it is that what the austerity people want is a society in which government expenditure is reduced to a tiny amount. All economic expenditure, the whole economy, ought from their point of view to be private. That's the logic of austerity and the austerity program, particularly as implemented in Britain. Well, the second point that one has to make is that one thinks about that, you realize that what austerity actually is an ideology of control. Keynes actually put it like that during the Great Depression. The fact that he discussed it, referred to it in that way, so many years ago, shows one that it is part of the armory of the ruling class to control. Of course, it wouldn't be needed. It wouldn't be needed if the inbuilt forms and controls of capital were actually functioning as they had done in the 19th century. In particular, mass unemployment, a genuine reserve army of labor, and secondly, that indeed the market controlled. Marx called this commodity fetishism. That's to say, what is crucial within in any economy is profit. And what's necessary is to reinvest that profit. If that is not done, it is argued, the economy collapses. The fact that what is necessary for any economy is workers who are engaged in production, who relate to employers or to firms in which they govern themselves, that in other words, what's essential to any economy is the social relations of that economy, and if the social relations themselves are exploitative, with some people control and some people work for others, that is to say, some people work, receive wages according to what the employer wants to pay, or according to what the firm can afford to pay, those people who are in the inferior position are clearly then being exploited by those who are in the superior position. Now, that relationship is hidden within the market. Therefore, when someone declares that what is necessary is that the market operate to the best of its ability, it should not be interfered with, prices must be allowed to adjust, profits must go to where they can go, then one knows that person is a defender of the status quo, is a defender of capital. So, to go back to the point, the defense of the market in that form, or the ideology that the market is eternal, it rules and is the best of all possible worlds, that it is automatic and above mankind, that it operates above mankind, that ideology is the ideology of capital itself, or as Marx calls it, commodity fetishism. But if that ideology is challenged or ridiculed or not believed, and if unemployment of the scale required to control the workforce is less than what is required, capital necessarily is insecure and tends to malfunction. Though one can argue that nothing else could in fact happen, that capital will necessarily malfunction, and that is simply its fate, because it is in decline in itself, and that is what I do argue. However, that's a separate issue. The point is that the capitalist class perceives this as something which is hindering its own growth. It therefore wants to cut the public sector. It wants to effectively build the private sector. It wants to ensure that the population accepts it. Under conditions where its fundamental controls, as I've just said, are under challenge, or have been under challenge for over a century or more, it needs other policies to buttress it. In the present time, one can put it under the heading of austerity. Now, Larry Elliott argues that the policy of Osborne, the policy of austerity, has failed. It's perfectly true, it has failed. And I would agree with him that it had to fail. But it wasn't a personal defeat. There is, after all, a policy of austerity in other countries, whether it's called austerity or not. By his definition, it's cutting a public expenditure rather than raising taxes. Using that definition, it applies not just to Britain and Germany, which are countries which openly proclaim that they are enforcing austerity on the country, but it applies to practically all developed countries today. So, Italy has repudiated it. Nonetheless, the new coalition government of the right and left, so-called, is going to implement cuts. The socialist government of France is implementing cuts, although it proclaims itself against austerity. So, we have a situation where, on the one hand, we have those who proclaim austerity, on the others who do not, who oppose it, but nonetheless are enforcing it. The point being that it is a necessary feature of the present time that there has to be a policy which goes beyond the ordinary policy of capital itself or its nature. That's to say, it has to buttress it. Now, it's clear that in the end, a simple policy of austerity means more than what Larry Elliott is talking about. He is calling for growth, which is quite correct, of course, that if one wants to reduce it, the actual expenditure, one would have to go for growth. And if one is to be realistic, one simply has to go for growth. The IMF is absolutely correct. However, one then is left with the question of why on earth, if that is true, why are they adopting this policy of control? I was just saying that it's necessary in order to maintain capital itself. I think that is true. But in this respect, the capitalist class is left with a problem that it doesn't really have a policy which can work. And its conservative section is saying, let us go back to the basis, the founding nature, if you want, of capital itself. In that case, we'll be more secure. And in addition, we have already defeated the forces of socialism. The Soviet Union isn't there. Never mind that it was Stalinist and not socialist. Most of them actually believe that it is, that it was socialist. And these various other countries which may have proclaimed themselves socialist look so bad that they no longer a hindrance. And the socialist parties which exist have as much to do with socialism as a crocodile with a cat. So, under these circumstances, we don't have to worry. We can simply defeat the working class and go for a pristine capital. That is the implication of, as it were, the die-hard austerity enforcers. And that's particularly true of Britain, that's true of the German bourgeoisie, and it's true, of course, of the right wing of the Republican Party, or the Republican Party itself. So, what is the likelihood of them succeeding? The answer is no, none whatsoever. It is simply not possible to go back to the 19th century. We don't live in a world of a large number of small firms each competing with another. We live in a world of monopoly, in fact, and it's the small firms which exist, which may or may not employ a large number of people, depending on the country, are dependent on the large firms, on the monopoly firms themselves. It's in the nature of those firms that they have a bureaucratic apparatus which has to be made to function. You can't make that bureaucratic apparatus function simply by order. It just doesn't work. Usually nowadays, the way they do it, they have a mission statement, they have various forms of encouragement, etc., etc. It's a whole discipline in itself to try and understand the nature of bureaucracy under capitalism. However, the point here is that if what they are going to do is discipline this bureaucracy, and that is where the white-collar working class today works to a considerable degree, if they're going to do that, they are likely to end up with a mess worse than what we've ever seen. It simply won't function at all. It'll just jam up. Well, we know that in America, the ordinary white-collar worker has had his wages effectively fixed since 73. If they continue with that policy and worse, it is impossible to imagine that capitalism will function in an efficient manner. It's not that it won't go on, and it's not that you will get a huge working class upsurge with mass unions. That will come over time. But in the first instance, you have to have an incentive system which works. You cannot have a policy as that of austerity, which is based on brutality and cruelty, because that is what it is. That's to say, if anybody falls out of the workforce for health reasons, or for 101 reasonable reasons, as it were, they then go bankrupt and fall under the wheels of the train, as it were. You cannot have a policy like that and expect the system to work. That's what it was like in the 19th century. It can't work and it won't work. Under modern conditions, whether it's in a factory or whether it's in a white-collar workforce, there has to be an incentive system of some kind which people accept. There has to be a reason why people are working, and not the simple reason that they are forced to work. Workers who are forced to work must work inefficiently or necessarily sabotage the system. So, simply for that reason, they can't bow back to the 19th century. Now, that is obvious, of course. It's obvious that you can't simply have a Nazi-type system, which is what it might well look like in the present context. I'd say Nazi-type system without the killing apparatus. But that is what one's actually talking about. They can't really go back, in other words. That isn't really an option. But that is what they're talking about. It may be they are dreaming, and it may be that they don't intend to go the whole way, and they hope that halfway will be good enough. And it may be that they understand nothing. All that is possible. But they are driving in that direction. So that's one section of the bourgeoisie. The other section is saying, well, look, that really isn't going to work. We have to accept what there is. And it's better to drop the ideology of austerity and instead implement the austerity in the terms of the Guardian writer, Larry Elliott. That's to say, simply cutting expenditure of the state. That's as far as we go. That means we cut welfare, but we don't go the whole way. And in addition, we compromise with the United States, we compromise with IMF, and we go for some level of growth. That appears to be the viewpoint of the other side. Well, the question is whether that can actually work. There's no doubt here that if there is growth, it will reduce the government deficit. But the point that I've been raising is that the policy of the capitalist class is more than that. They want to find a modus vivendi whereby they can run capital without the threat that workers will demand not just higher wages, but greater control. They want freedom to do what they want without considering their workers, as it were, or consider them only up to a certain point. It's a utopian concept. It isn't possible, in fact. And that is the essential point that I'm making. Thank you.